Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Smithsonian Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. Today, I'll be reading articles from the January-February 2025 issue of the Smithsonian Magazine. I hope you enjoy the program. We'll begin with this article, Diving for History. In the waterways of the Midwest, researchers uncover boats as old as the pyramids. By Jacqueline Kehoe. Tamara Thompson was 25 feet underwater when she spotted it, the decaying end of a dugout canoe, a great white oak carved some 1,200 years ago. It was jutting out of a sandy ridge in Wisconsin's Lake Mendota, a body of water skirting Madison, the state capital, and she knew it was a remarkable find. What I did not understand was the breadth of the discovery. Thompson was diving that summer day in 2021 as a private citizen, chasing fish and collecting trash. More often you'll find the maritime archaeologist in the Great Lakes surveying deep water sites for the Wisconsin Historical Society. Lake Mendota had not been on the archaeologist's radar, and she certainly wasn't hunting for dugout canoes. Thompson usually looks for shipwrecks, like 19th-century freighters. It might seem remarkable that she recognized the find for what it was. Dugout canoes, the world's oldest boat type found to date, are simply hollowed-out logs. In 2018, however, Thompson had teamed up with Cecil Schroeder, an archaeologist with the University of Wisconsin-Madison, to help an undergraduate student catalog Wisconsin's extant dugout canoes. When the project began, historians believed 11 existed in collections across the state. Less than a year later, after scouring private collections, supper clubs, local museums, and more, the team had counted 34. Thompson's 2021 find spurred the two women to continue their hunt and take it public. Establishing the Wisconsin Dugout Canoe Survey Project, the pair and helpers have so far documented a full 79 dugout canoes, including two of the 10 oldest dugouts found in eastern North America, ranging between 4,000 and 5,000 years old. Wisconsin's dugout catalog sheds light on indigenous knowledge, habits of trade and travel, and even environmental adaptation. But the project also conjures a sense of magic in the familiar. To travel thousands of years back into history, look no further than America's urban lakes and rivers. The Madison area, known as Deshopi in the Ho-Chunk language, was an indigenous metropolis before the arrival of Europeans, says Bill Quackenbush, tribal historic preservation officer for the Ho-Chunk Nation, one of Wisconsin's 11 federally recognized tribes. Deshopi was a richly interconnected society. There's this misconception that we had temporary villages here and there, Quackenbush says, but Madison was one large living community. Carving dugout canoes would have been a community occasion, Quackenbush explains. Men would work multiple logs while families gathered, ate, and prepared for the coming season. The carving process, with shells or stone tools, could take weeks or even months. Once complete, a canoe would sit alongside the shoreline for the whole village to use. Nearly as vital to thriving as fire, a working canoe meant open trade and shipping networks, fishing in deeper waters, and travel to faraway places. In winter, the Ho-Chunk would secure the vessels in shallow water to prevent them from drying out before spring. In fact, a map of the found dugouts show us not just where this community lived, but how it moved and changed in pace with the earth over millennia. Just 300 yards from where Thompson found that first canoe in Mendota, she later uncovered a cache of at least 10 canoes along an underwater ridge that geologists have identified as a previous, now lost shoreline, a beach in the savannas of ancient Dajopi. "No one does this," says Amy Rosenbrow, Wisconsin State archaeologist, referring to the relatively new approach of treating small urban waterways as potential archaeological sites. "The only thing even comparable to that I can think of is the mud skippers in London who walk up and down the Thames. Like those mud skippers, also known as mud larks, who scour riverbanks for artifacts from London's past, Roman pottery, Victorian silverware, everyday citizens report dugout sightings across Wisconsin. The best specimens have wound up at historical societies and museums, including a Menominee canoe currently sitting in Smithsonian Institution storage in Maryland. Some are hung high above supper club tables or auctioned off to private collectors. A few, miraculously, have managed to stay within their tribes, including the Ho-Chunk, the Menominee, and the Lac du Flambeau. It is the rumors of still submerged specimens, mostly antidotes from hunters, fishers, and boaters, that make Thompson and Schroeder put in serious legwork. Receiving leads via a tip line, the women then go hunting themselves, diving, wading, or kayaking in Wisconsin's bogs and shallow lakes, with little more to guide them than loose coordinates and a snorkel. The duo has thus far confirmed 79 of 112 reports across the state, and new ones are still popping up with regularity. Most of the finds are in surprisingly good condition. A few have even been accompanied by paddles or tools, like net sinkers and an adze, a wood-cutting implement similar to an axe. Some have turned out to be fragments, which is even more remarkable. The worse the specimen, the more likely it's deemed kindling and thrown on the fire. When they locate a dugout, Thompson and Schroeder start by collecting data the old-fashioned way. They fill notebooks with drawings, measurements, and lists of stylistic quirks, from thwarks, which are structural crosspieces, and drag marks, to charring and paint. Leaving all specimens in situ, Thompson then does photogrammetry using a GoPro camera. When working above ground, she also uses LIDAR, or light detection and ranging, a remote measuring sensor built into newer iPhones and iPads that, with a 3D scanning app, can create an instant 3D model for further study. "Sometimes the GoPro works, and sometimes the LIDAR works," says Thompson. "Sometimes they're possessed by spirits, and they don't want to be scanned at all." When possible, the duo also takes a sample of wood about the size of a matchstick, typically from the outer part of the canoe, for further analysis and dating. Ranging in age from 150 to nearly 5,000 years, varying in length from 7 to 36 feet, many canoes post-date the arrival of Europeans. Once in a while, though, they'll find a specimen that shares a timeline with Beowulf, the Phoenician alphabet, or even early math. Thompson has made discoveries at Lake Mendota that stand as some of the state's oldest. Carbon dating places her first find at 1,200 years old, and her second around 3,000 years old. The Mendota cache currently includes the survey's oldest, an elm dugout carbon dated at more than 4,500 years old. Beyond carbon dating, certain samples also undergo strontium isotope analysis, a means of measuring neutron variation within the same element to determine where that element originated. Wood type is identified via the Forest Products Laboratory, a national research laboratory of the United States Forest Service, conveniently down the street from Schroeder's office. Thompson and Schroeder have also sent a few samples to University of Wisconsin-Platteville for dendrochronology studies, because tree ring data, which helps date the canoes, can also shed light on past climates. Using those four methods of analysis, the scientists framed their hypotheses. Across indigenous groups, for example, prevailing wisdom says that dugouts were carved from soft woods, like pine or cypress. But a third of the survey's dugouts have turned out to be hardwoods, including oak, hickory, and elm. The latter is known for its tough, interlocking grain, and its modern reputation for requiring the use of power tools. If we start to parse this data by time, explains Schroeder, it ends up telling a story of traditional ecological knowledge and cultural ingenuity. Wood type, even without tree ring data, provides clues to Wisconsin's past environments. Thousands of years ago, southern Wisconsin transitioned from a closed canopy oak forest to an oak savanna. In an open prairie, oaks, instead of growing straight and tall, branched too early for canoe making. The ancient Ho-Chunk, who also inhabited modern-day Illinois and elsewhere, then turned to the arrow-straight elm, despite its unyielding hardwood structure. Similar patterns follow after European contact, when settlers felled northern Wisconsin's white pine forests. Tribes like the Menominee turned to trees such as hemlock and butternut. Variations aside, most dugouts look roughly the same to the untrained eye, which is striking, since their makers had vastly different resources and tools. 3,000 years ago, the Ho-Chunk were carving in a world before agriculture and pottery. The design needed no improvement. As Quackenbush puts it, when something works, why change it? With the dugout buzz circulating around Lake Mendota, Thompson's discoveries have made international headlines. Madison's Ho-Chunk population has found an opportunity to reconnect with its past, Quackenbush says. In 2022, a group of Ho-Chunk youth and tribal members finished carving a fresh cottonwood canoe using traditional methods and then paddled it across the city's four lakes. In the summer of 2024, tribal members carved another and took it down the Mississippi River. Quackenbush, who works closely with the Wisconsin Historical Society, has taken up his own hunt, too. An expert in ground-penetrating radar, or GPR, he's leading his team in the search for more Lake Mendota artifacts, from canoes to campfire rings. We're always looking for layers of information that we can share even within our own tribal communities, he explains. We need that connection. We're wrapped up in the same fast pace of today. Thompson and Schroeder consider the local tribes and all the citizens involved in the project as partners in their research, a debt they acknowledge in every public talk they give. Other states seem to be taking inspiration from Wisconsin. Minnesota, Michigan, and others have started cataloging their own canoe archives, while the Society for American Archaeology devoted a symposium last year entirely to the humble dugout. Unlike many artifacts, canoes offer an inviting point of entry to the past, Rose Brough says. People have a lot of trouble connecting to spear points, she says, but people know canoes, and they know lakes, and it's bracing to recognize that those depths might hold the ultimate sunken treasure. That completes the article. The author, Jacqueline Kehoe, is a Wisconsin-based writer and photographer focused on science, nature, and travel. And the name of her article was Diving for History. The next article is Bold Type. On her beloved typewriters, Octavia Butler tapped out a prescient course for science fiction by Stephen Kearse. Octavia E. Butler didn't like to wait for inspiration. In fact, the celebrated science fiction author denounced the idea of waiting for one's muse. Habit is more dependable. The storyteller's prolificacy is testament to her diligent, lifelong writing habit. Over her 35-year career, Butler used the fantastical narratives of science fiction to explore the complexities and cruelties of survival. Among other things, by placing black people at the center of her stories, she boldly defied the ways of her beloved but often conservative genre. "I wrote myself in," she once said. Her tales of power-hungry telepaths and erotic alien encounters are now canonical in science fiction and beyond. The prescience of her parable books, which feature environmental disasters and a leader who wants to, quote, make America great again, has been especially praised. Even today, says Jerry Canavan, author of a 2016 Butler biography, it just feels like she predicts the future. Born an only child in Pasadena, California in 1947, Butler grew up poor, raised by her mother and grandmother. Her father, a shoe shiner, died when she was three. Her mother, a day laborer who had to leave school at age 10 to work, cleaned houses under the demeaning conditions of the Jim Crow era. Butler sometimes accompanied her mom on the job, where they were required to enter homes through back doors. Writing became a way of escaping those circumstances. Their lives seemed so terrible to me at times, so devoid of joy or reward, Butler said of her mother's and grandmother's service jobs. I needed my fantasies to shield me from their world. She first put her ideas to paper as a 10-year-old, scrawling stories of magical horses in notebooks, and later pecking away on a typewriter she'd begged her mom to purchase. She began submitting stories to science fiction magazines in 1960, amassing rejections until 1970 when she sold her first tale, Child Finder, a story about a telepath working to help psychic children. Throughout her years of obscurity, Butler rose daily to write before menial jobs as a potato chip inspector, dishwasher, and telemarketer. She also jotted down ideas while crisscrossing Los Angeles on public buses, using the people she observed to plot potential characters and scenarios. 12 published novels and 2 short story collections resulted from this steadfast dedication. Butler found her stride after publishing her debut novel, Pattern Master, in 1976, producing a book a year until 1980. Mainstream success largely eluded her over the following decade, though she won multiple Hugo and Nebula Awards, the highest honors in science fiction. While her output began to slow, her reputation grew, and in 1995 she became the first science fiction author to win a prestigious MacArthur Grant. Her stories often challenged the basic premises of classic sci-fi, imagining, for example, the ways humans might submit to alien captors rather than resist them. In books such as Dawn and Kindred, Butler showed the ways that gender, race, and sexuality inform visions of the future and past, a writing habit that began as a means of escaping her present became a way of revealing its secrets. The author did much of this imagineering on typewriters. Her first model was a portable Remington, her second a gift from her early mentor, the larger-than-life science fiction author and editor Harlan Ellison. Several, sadly, were stolen from her home in Los Angeles over the years. She donated one of her well-loved typewriters, this trapezoidal Olivetti Studio 46, painted a cool powder blue, to the Anacostia Community Museum for its 2003-2004 All the Stories Are True exhibition, which celebrated Black American literature. By the time she donated this machine, Butler was widely revered as one of the architects of Afrofuturism. 2 years after the exhibition, Butler died at the age of 58. Even in Butler's most difficult moments, such as the death of her mother in 1996, her habit kept her going. "The major tragedies in life, there's just no compensation," she told the Los Angeles Times in 1998 while promoting her novel Parable of the Talents. "The story, you see, will get you through." That completes the article Bold Type by Stephen Kearse. The final article today is Feast Your Eyes. In food, the Impressionists found a rich and satisfying subject matter, by Amy Crawford. France has long derived a portion of its national pride from its culinary sophistication. But during the late 19th century, a time of war and social upheaval, as well as the cultural flowering of the Belle Epoque, the issue of food could sometimes be fraught. Aristocrats feasted while peasants toiled and poor Parisians starved, and new delicacies like the banana debuted against a backdrop of imperialist adventures. To artists like Claude Monet and Paul Gauguin, all of it was also rich fodder for a new approach to painting. Showcased in the play of light over a silver pitcher or the slimy floors of a bustling fish market. This is as much a social history as it is the story of food, says Mark Scala, chief curator at the Frist Art Museum in Nashville, which in late January will host the traveling exhibition Farm to Table, featuring some 50 Impressionist canvases and sculptures that depict markets and gardens, farmers and gastronomes, abundance and penury. Food, that universal human obsession, connects people from all walks of life, Scala notes, making it a portal through which artists and museum goers can explore not only human appetites, but also darker questions of class, conflict, and conquest. And that completes the article The title was Feast Your Eyes by Amy Crawford. And that completes the broadcast for today. This has been the Smithsonian Magazine program, brought to you by Sunsounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your Sunsounds volunteer reader. The articles I've been reading are from the January-February 2025 issue of the Smithsonian Magazine. I hope you enjoyed the articles, and I hope you found them informative. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week, and keep listening to the premium programming offered by Sunsounds of Arizona on a 24/7 basis. And if you've missed a program you'd like to hear, go to the sunsounds.org website. Click on the broadcast info and audio, then click on the words Demand Podcasts. On the next sheet, you'll see a list of programs that are available to you. Hopefully, you'll find the one you're looking for. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.